Well, when Amy and I moved here from another state, one of the obligations that we had to attend to was getting an Indiana driver's license. And to do that, we had to take a test to prove that we knew the rules of the road. If we were going to drive on Indiana's highways, we needed to know what expectations there were for good driving practices. For example, if we had come from the UK, we would have realized that people here drove on the wrong side of the road, except it's the right side. If we had come from some other countries, we would have noticed that people here actually stop at stop signs. And stoplights are actually observed virtually all of the time. Obeying no passing zones is also another custom that's generally practiced in this state. And there are usually consequences if we don't practice these obeying these rules of the road. Now, all of these simple rules are designed for efficient and safe interaction for all the people who travel on the roads, both in this state and most others. This is what we have to do in order to get along well with the rest of humanity that's using the same roads that we are. That's the purpose of the rules of the road. Well, that's one homely example of why Jesus established the 10 words, which we commonly refer to as the 10 Commandments, the Exodus passage, which was already read today. When the children of Israel were being formed into a people in the wilderness, into a distinctive people group or tribe, they needed to know what were the guidelines that they were to follow, how they would establish the appropriate social conventions that would identify them as the people of God, how they were to interact both with one another as well as with strangers around them. And these 10 words established the expectations and the practices of both how Israel was to relate to their sisters and brothers as well as their neighbors. Now, some of these words would be very familiar with other culture groups, and yet others were quite specific and made Israel a distinctive people, identifying how they were to live and worship God. Now, when we get to the stories of Jesus in the Second or the New Testament, we find that much of what he talked about and what he did with his life was, in a sense, a critique of how Israel had been living out or not living out the 10 words. The way in which they applied those words had somehow, in his mind, deteriorated over the years. And we must confess, or at least I'll confess for myself, that in all these years of driving, there are some rules of the road which I obey all the time. There are other rules of the road which I obey most of the time. And in some people's minds, there are certain rules that I'm fairly selective in whether or not I obey. Today's text in the gospel is about Jesus cleansing the temple. The story shows up in all four of our gospel accounts, but the writer of John's gospel puts it at the outset or the beginning of his ministry, whereas the other three gospels put it near the end. It's part of the triumphal entry into Jerusalem in the final stages of Jesus' ministry. Now, we'll leave for another day the discussion about the chronology and why John puts it in a different place. And there's also the interesting comments that Jesus makes about what temple means. But that's another sermon for another day. This was, and all the gospel writers agree on this, this was the Passover time. And so we might think of this as the preeminent celebration time for Israel. The crowds would be larger. And for those who were conducting business in the temple, a lot more commerce was taking place. Think Christmas time at the mall. This is when all the retail business was taking place. Now, what I want us to consider in John's gospel story is why he told it the way he did. This is the only gospel account that describes both how and with what instrument Jesus drives those out of the temple. Now, it might be fair to say that the animals actually get more attention in John's gospel than in the other three gospels. Doves get a passing notice in two of the gospel accounts, but this is the only text in which the sheep and the cattle play a central role. When I have seen examples of the text displayed artistically, it's usually rendered in the following fashion. This is El Greco's painting, likely from the beginning of the 17th century, and you will notice that there are no animals visible in this picture. And Jesus is driving out people with a whip. It's a small whip. It might be kind of hard to see from that distance. But he does have the whip in his hand, and it's against people. Now, in my unscientific survey of all the depictions of Christ cleansing the temple, this is the most prevalent scene, and that this is the way in which it is generally depicted. However, the next picture shows Jesus driving people out without a whip, which is the way in which the three synoptic gospels talk about it. And again, there are no animals seen in this picture. Now, the third picture, which is ironically from Sweet Media, shows the anger of Jesus as he overturns the money changers' table and drives them out. Finally, the fourth painting from Peter Ertzen is from the 16th century and does have animals present, as John's gospel tells us. But again, even though the animals are present, Jesus appears to be driving people out of the temple rather than the animals. In fact, if you look, at least in my observation, the animals don't seem to be too interested in Jesus' activity here. They're pretty casual about all of this. Well, these are the ways in which cleansing the temple may show up in our mind's eyes as well as in the artistic representations. Because the synoptic gospels focus on people, that is what is depicted in most of the paintings that we see. Jesus is forcefully driving people out of the temple. People who have, in his opinion, abandoned the true meaning of the 10 words and focused rather on certain forms of religion that have actually lined their pockets with greater wealth. They've turned their observation of religious life into something to their own advantage, a commercial transaction, if you will, rather than a sign of devotion to their Creator. Now, in some ways, I believe most of us have pictures in our own minds of how Jesus might have cleansed the temple. And perhaps artistic renditions such as these have helped to shape the images within our minds. But I believe that we read the story in whichever gospel account, and we insert our own imagination as to what really happened. This is why I think this week's Psalm, Psalm 19, is such an important one to remember. Because if we look particularly, it talks about the holiness and the gloriousness and the goldenness and the sweetness of God's law. But it also talks about, in verse 12, it asks that important question. But who can detect their errors? Clear me, God, from hidden faults. As we seek to be faithful, we cannot see our own blind spots. Otherwise, they wouldn't be blind spots. It's often hardest for us to see how we have projected our own mindset onto the activity and the stories of God. Now, I don't claim to be an art critic, nor do I claim to know the mindset of every artist. But I do know how I have received sermons on this text in the past. And essentially what I have heard in this text, as this is when we finally get to see the anger of God expressed and embodied in Jesus' actions. This is the righteous indignation when the bad guys finally get what's coming to them. And they get it at the hand of Jesus. He's no longer the namby-pamby guru of peaceful beatitudes, but he's the Rambo-type deliverer of strong justice. And most of the paintings render this gospel account in that direction. And so for peacemaking people, often our friends who challenge us on that tenet of ours, point to this episode in Jesus' ministry and say, so, what do you do with this text? And I believe John's gospel offers us a legitimate answer. Who or what is Jesus driving out of the temple? If we look at the text in John's gospel, for what it actually says, rather than what we think it says, this gospel makes a point that Jesus fashions a whip of cords as his only weapon, if you will. Now, since temple practice prohibited sticks and weapons from being present in the temple area, remember, this is Jerusalem, not America. The only tool that he had at his disposal was likely taking the reeds that were used for the bedding for the livestock. It was most likely these reeds that he wound into a cord to drive out the animals. He had brought nothing into the temple, so he had to fashion something out of what was already there in order to produce his whip of cords. And the reeds used for bedding for the animals was likely the most usable source of material. Now, in consulting with Assembly's resident animal trainer / administrative assistant, Naomi Roots, she observed that the effectiveness, if at all, of a rolled-up newspaper that a dog owner might use when the pet transgressed, say, for example, peed on the carpet, is the arm being raised in what is perceived as a threatening gesture. It's the aggressive movement of the body that conveys the intended desire, not the harmless swat on the behind, which may issue a loud sound, but no pain. And I would suggest that in the same way, Jesus uses the gesture of the raised arm holding this whip of benign cords to convey to the livestock that they are to move out of the temple area. By no means does even striking them with the whip inflict pain. Jesus is not, therefore, acting violently as a way to show his devotion to the true purpose of the temple. Rather, he is seeking to restore it to its rightful place of honor in Israel's worship. He's calling for a change, and a dramatic one at that, but he's not doing it in a violent manner. Now, without getting too technical about the rendition of the Greek in John's Gospel with respect to verse 15 of chapter 2, there are primarily two possible readings. One is, he drove out all of the temple and the sheep and the oxen. And the other reading is, he drove all out of the temple, both the sheep and the oxen. Now, for certain linguistic reasons, which only Paul would probably appreciate, we'll not go into that right now. But the second reading makes more sense. Additionally, if we read on to the rest of the text, Jesus then turns over the tables of the money changers and addresses those selling doves. This chronological order suggests that the people have not been driven out from the temple area, only the animals. Now, another point in favor of this second reading, that Jesus drove out the animals and not the people, is that all the people out of the temple would have been logistically difficult for a single person to achieve, because the temple area we're talking about is roughly 980 feet by 1,475 feet, a rather significant large area. One could imagine the effect of Jesus driving out the animals was that their owners also left in order to recapture them, because that was the capital of their business, as the money changers probably tried to scoop up the capital of their business that was strewn on the ground after Jesus turned over the temples or the tables. But the idea of Jesus doing violence to people in a way that's often depicted in the artwork and in our own minds doesn't bear justification in John's telling of the story. The other gospel writers don't mention a whip at all, and John is the only one who mentions livestock for which the whip of cords would be the means to drive them out in a humane way. I'd like to suggest that a careful reading of John's text offers us an alternative vision of this episode of Jesus' life from that which is depicted in virtually all the paintings that we see, regardless of the era in which they were created. In one sense, we can read this as Jesus freeing the animals from the confines of the temple court. He was challenging the predatory livelihood of the merchants. He was cleaning house, if you will, so that there would be more room for people, all people, to find space in the temple area, both the chosen of Israel as well as the Gentile seekers who could find space in the outer court. Understood in this way, Jesus at the outset of his ministry is taking a defining action to talk about how he is about the messianic business of purifying the temple. One can understand that his driving out the animals is a way of protesting their presence in a sacred space. Or it could be making even the further statement of protesting the sacrificial practice in general. He is fulfilling the first or Old Testament prophetic words of the prohibition of merchants in the temple, Zechariah 14:21. He's demonstrating a zeal for the house of the Lord as reflected in Psalm 69. And he may be suggesting doing away with the sacrifice in this new dawning kingdom that Hosea spoke about in chapter 6. Indeed, Jesus does all of this with passion that includes compassion. He acts decisively without acting violently. He may be forceful, but he's not physically harmful in his actions. Which brings us back to the question of how then shall we live? There's one line of thought among people seeking to be faithful that if we practice our faith sacrificially, we don't have to practice mercy. Jesus seems to call that kind of logic into question with parables like the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son. For in both of those parables, the conventional good guys would have lived ritually pure lives. In the Good Samaritan story, the priest and the Levite may have felt that they have ritually fulfilled their lives. They've completed their faithfulness, and so they're exempt from helping the bleeding stranger on the road. They've done everything necessary to fulfill the law. In the Prodigal Son story, the older son felt that he had slavishly kept the law, particularly with respect to his father. And he resented the fact that his father was treating his irresponsible younger brother the way he was. One story speaks about the lack of mercy on the part of some, and the other story speaks of the resentment toward those who do show mercy toward so-called undeserving people. Perhaps we feel entitled to our riches and comforts as Westerners because we have followed the rules and we're entitled to the fruits of our labor. We felt we've done enough and don't need to concern ourselves with the plight of others. But Jesus turns upside down more than simply tables. He acts provocatively, to be sure, but in ways that are designed to get our attention, not to harm our bodies. He invites us to see another way to be faithful, one that does not leave the poor and the disenfranchised out, one that does not take advantage of those whose lives have not been blessed in the same particular way and have had the same opportunities that we may have had. Perhaps what Jesus is calling us to do is to begin to live out the reign of God values now, here. What kind of house cleaning do we need to do this Lenten season in order to have room for what's really important? For when we make room for God and our neighbor above all else, that will be good news indeed.